Hey, it's Bill Simmons from The Ringer, and this is a podcast called The Rewatchables. We have been doing it really since 2017. It started with how much we love the movie Heat. We decided to structure a whole podcast with categories: most rewatchable scene, who won the movie, Apex Mountain, what age the best. But here's the thing. If you want the full archive, you can hear them only on Spotify, for free, by the way. So make sure to follow The Rewatchables on Spotify.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else.
I need sports staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me in the studio is just a MySpace guy in a Threads world. It's Andy Greenwald!
How dare you? How dare you?
No, I mean, MySpace was your real platform. That was your real, that was your bullhorn. You
disagree.
Know?
Friendster.
Oh, yeah.
I've said this before. I think the best writing I ever did was in testimonials for people on Friendster.
Did you ever write me one?
I'm sure I did.
Yeah.
Too bad that's lost time.
Greenwald, great to see you. What a special show today, because Christopher Storer, the creator, director, guy behind The Bear, is joining us on the show today. So we're going to have a nice long chat with him. Before we get there, there's always stuff happening in the world of pop culture that needs just your very specific eye and voice.
Just mine? What are you setting me up today?
I like to be your OC. You know what I mean? I put you in space. I let you make plays, get some yak.
You're making it sound like you're the T-ball. You know, like you're the T for me to hit the ball.
No. I'm Kyle Shanahan.
Oh, so you get it most of the way there, and then work with that.
How you doing, man? It's good to see you. Was your weekend nice?
Lovely. Beautiful, beautiful holiday weekend that was basically like 2 weeks because it was a Tuesday.
Right.
So it still felt like a holiday weekend.
Oh, right. This past weekend wasn't a holiday, was it?
It felt like one
still.
Okay,
just partly making sure
because
I didn't skip
everyone
a holiday.
In this studio knows that because my kids didn't have camp, so I was...
Oh, yeah.
I was Is that out of office?
Yes.
I was just, with them for like 5 days.
Parenting.
It was very fun.
I feel the need to bring...
Yeah.
The positive vibes today. And Chris will help us because he made the show of the year so far. So until Special Ops Lioness comes out, he has that belt. But I feel the need to be positive because I do feel like we were a little bit depressing on Thursday.
Oh, and I have a few more things coming off of that, as you know.
Okay.
Do you want me to do that before you get positive?
Do you want to continue to be negative and then we go positive?
No, my thing, you're going to love this. This is what's like, there's a zig and there's a zag, and then what comes after that?
I don't know.
We need to
iterate.
There's an Andy. Yeah, there's me. I want to go one step past that because I do feel like, you know, sometimes the reply guy squawking reaches me in my ivory tower. And I feel like there were two things that
were
misunderstood.
What's the box that you go into? What's the box they build for phones for like when they're doing like...
The Faraday cage?
Yeah. That's what you live in.
Yeah, but it's more of an ADU.
Just doing 100% parenting.
Just pure liquid parenting. That's when you have a little bit to drink and then parent. I think there were two things that were misunderstood because I did say, I believe, and I don't have the tape. Maybe Kai can run it back. I believe I did say, fuck brands.
Yeah.
I wasn't saying that I hate capitalism.
Uh-huh.
Because I love commercials, both in the sense that they keep our podcast afloat, but also they probably will save television.
Sure.
what I feel like people didn't understand is this was what you actually introduced, this idea. We are not fans of the Mattel Toy Corporation and everything that they do.
Yeah, right.
Like, I enjoy a product. I don't want the expanded cinematic universe of Thomas's English Muffins.
My sneakers don't need a sole.
No. Right? Well, actually, they do.
Well, yeah, okay.
Because that's a part of a shoe.
Nice pun. But like, they just, I don't need to know the values.
That was the one thing that I wanted to clarify. The other thing is, I think people are like, oh, typical Gen X grumbling that things used to be better. And fair.
Yeah.
You know what you subscribe to when you signed up for this podcast. But my point about people deserving better choices, and I think wanting different things than what they're being served, to my mind is an optimistic point. Because I do think that quality material or more original material could find an audience if the system was set up to support it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would rather people optimistically be trying to make mass culture entertainment that is good rather than, or using their problem-solving brains to do that, rather than using the problem-solving brains to turn Yahtzee into a Blumhouse-inspired horror movie.
Sure. I mean, I think that also when you come out of a conversation like the one we had last Thursday, and for anybody who didn't listen and is like, what the fuck are these guys talking about? We basically were bemoaning the state of televised and projected narrative culture.
Yeah.
And it was coming out of an article that was in The New Yorker about Barbie, which apparently people love and is on track to make $95 million and is going to be this giant success story. And it's actually like, that's great. Yeah. That is great. I think the rising tide will lift boats, and I think Oppenheimer will do well.
Does Skipper have a boat set? Is that what you meant?
No, but, and then there's also like, as soon as that podcast was basically over, I saw two movies in successive nights that wound up being two of my favorite movies of the year. I saw Asteroid City on Friday.
Nice.
And I saw How to Blow Up a Pipeline on Saturday, which was truly a mind-blowing movie. Like, just how well made it was is just so, it's so accomplished and is so free of so much of the bullshit that comes along with movies right now. So like, there's, everywhere you look, there's reasons to be hopeful. I think it was more, there is like, it's hard to be, it's hard to like find enough places to look.
There's good stuff. There will be good stuff. There are talented people. The story of the state of the industry is only valid until the next thing comes out. Mm-hmm. And it can change completely and it can turn on a dime. I just think that through consolidation and through just the state of the economy and things, we're not getting the best choices.
Right.
We're not getting the best opportunities to see things that are good. The Bear is a good example, is a good thing to be talking more about this week because The Bear is good.
Mm-hmm.
It is objectively and subjectively and qualitatively, it is good and it is a hit. And I think that's interesting. And I think that's significant. And I think it matters. And I don't think all is lost, but I do think that we are losing a lot with the hyper-focus on really telling the narrative story of brands. I get why they're doing it, but we deserve better.
Another thing that will give us a ray of hope, although a little bit bittersweet, is Reservation Dogs, which comes back in early August, I believe.
I think August 1st, even.
August 1st. And the trailer for that dropped a couple of days ago, or last week.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also announced that it would be its final season. Sterling Harjo put out a statement where he was just like, I feel like I've said what I wanted to say with this show. And when we wrote the end of season three, we felt like we had really arrived at the place where the show should end. I feel like we've kind of attacked and broken down pre-ending announcements in every single way, probably coming off of Succession. This was like a major talking point as to whether or not it needed to end there or it had to end there or what happened in the show because it was ending. But for Reservation Dogs, I completely see where he's coming from. You know, this show could go on for 10 years. It's fine that it's ending after three. I think he's got the story he wants to tell about this specific group of people, and I can't wait for it to come back.
I'm going to disagree with you.
Okay.
I'm furious.
Well, you're a consumer.
I am actually furious about this one. And I mean this with a great deal of respect for Sterling Harjo and his creative choices, and everything you're saying is accurate and true. But this is the one that really stuck in my craw to a surprising degree. Because, as we've said for the last 2 years, now going on 3 years, this is one of the top three best shows on television consistently. It is also the most incredible vessel to tell almost any kind of story. And I adore it for that. And I'm just really frustrated that it's not going to keep going for 10 years. I don't know. But for more years, you know, it did not feel as tied to a narrative anchor as something like Succession, which I think, though it was also bittersweet, we said multiple times that it could start to get a little Billions-y if it kept going.
Sure.
And we understand the desire not to keep going. I also think that if you read between the lines of the press statements, that it's clear that Sterling Harjo is going to continue to do what he has been doing even before the larger national spotlight was on him, which is to tell really fascinating, really funny, really compelling native stories in a variety of mediums with a lot of the same crew and community and actors, and sometimes even people playing the same parts. Mm-hmm. So I have the feeling that the Res Dogs expanded universe will continue to expand. But it was bracing to watch this trailer, and it feels like a different show in the sense that suddenly it is about
the end.
The end. And about these four kids finding closure in their emotional arc that spun out from their friend Daniel's death.
I think that it's interesting that we're talking to Chris today, because I've been thinking about this with The Bear a lot, with the sustainability of certain shows. Mm-hmm. You talked about narrative sustainability in terms of Succession, but there's also a tonal sustainability. And for The Bear, it's obviously that intensity, which I think they made some inroads into releasing some pressure in various places in the show, like over the course of the second season, although, you know, obviously episode 6 would suggest otherwise. But for the most part, I think that they found some like other notes to play other than all the atoms in my body are exploding at once when this ticket machine is pumping out orders. And you wonder how much longer, not only can they do it physically, but also can those characters be in that state? Because that's not really how life always works. And I think for Reservation Dogs, you could have told a never-ending story about life in this place and loosely about these people. But it seems like the story that Sterling wants to tell is about these kids who are stuck in between childhood and adulthood and dealing with grief sincerely for the first time in their lives in a lot of ways, and how they move on from that. And then this season will be the capstone on that story.
And about staying or going.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things the show does so well is communicate that this is a place where these characters live. This community has been there, and there's a reason why they've been there, and there's these old connections and old relationships, some that have curdled and some that continue to blossom, and that's still a fount for stories for him. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, he's a filmmaker. And
it's also probably hard because those kids are growing up.
Yes.
So like,
and have other opportunities, and he doesn't want to stand in the way of that. And this is also relevant to Chris Storer from The Bear, not just because of the FX connection, but Chris and Sterling are both writer-directors and filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And that is a powerful itch to do different things. So I'm not genuinely angry at him, I hope. And I'm not just saying this because I hope he'll come back on the podcast for a third time. It's also just that, man, I am upset. I love that show and I want more.
So we really like did this whole like the roof is on fire thing. Mm-hmm. Sky's falling on Thursday. And you can take what we talked about on Thursday and be like, well, the only things that like make these guys happy are these relatively niche arty shows, right? The Bear, Reservation Dogs, whatever. I mean, The Bear is successful, but you know what I mean? I just want to let people know. Mm-hmm. That other things can scratch our itch. Other things can make us happy. And one of those things is Idris Elba negotiating with hijackers on a plane from Dubai to London. And they called the show Hijack.
Great title.
And it stars Idris Elba, and he's a negotiator who happens to be on a plane that gets hijacked, and he negotiates with them. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty good. It's on Apple TV, by the way.
You kind of feel like the people created the show got 6 months money to like do pre-production, and they just bought a copy of Rick Rubin's book because they were like, no, we told you the show when you bought it. Idris Elba's on a plane.
Yeah.
The complete lack of anything else going on is pure.
Yeah.
And I appreciate it so much. I there are a couple faces that I think I recognize in the ensemble cast. But broadly, I don't know anyone.
There's like an Andor guy as the pilot.
That's the guy I recognize. Yeah. Yes. That's Mon Mothma's husband, right?
Yes. No, her ex-boyfriend from childhood, who's like also the revolutionary.
Okay, thank you for that. I wondered. But otherwise, nope, don't know. That's fine.
Yeah.
It's what it says on the package. Just open and enjoy. And I mean, I only watch one. I think so. They're dropping these every week, and there's six?
I think there's six or seven, yeah. And there's like an element of real-timeness to it, I think. But I found this show to be like basically the Apple version, aka more expensive and higher production value, maybe, version of really reliable ABC or Fox thrillers from the earlier part of the century.
Yeah.
Where you're just like, God damn, 24, early 24 is really good. Or like this show on ABC, like not Grey's or something like that, but it's just like it has real network sensibilities in its broad appeal, but also has like a certain, like, it looks like that plane set costs a pretty penny, you know?
Yeah. The Apple's budget remains Apple's budget, but it's interesting the way you're saying, because this could be so many different things. This used to be a movie. In fact, this has been a movie multiple times.
Yeah.
Passenger 57 and Executive Decision.
Yeah, like, Air Force One. Yeah.
Yes. This has been done. And even that makes sense for television, because what is successful television if not just the sort of like the simulacrum shape of entertainments we've felt before? Like, we know what's coming. It's called Hijack.
Yeah.
So you don't watch the first half hour being like, oh, I hope he gets home to London quickly. You know.
Yeah.
That's fine.
It's so funny because the pilot's just like, clear skies as we fly from Dubai to Heathrow.
There'll be no problems whatsoever.
Yeah.
I also think that to talk about the show kind of does run counter to a lot of what I generally talk about on the podcast, or what I want, because the thing that sets apart a lot of the programs that we love, like Res Dogs, like The Bear, is you can really feel the soul in the machine. There's someone making a decision, or someone with a particular aesthetic that is bringing something, whether it's a song on the soundtrack, or a quirk in the performance, or just a character beat that's like, oh, someone added that and fought to keep it in there. There's none of that here that I can tell whatsoever, and I'm not mad about it.
Except for one thing.
Well, because I did want to point out that, like, the opening theme and, like, credits thing, I feel like AI is already in Hollywood, because I just can't believe anyone was like, that song rules.
Well, it's just like a slow jazz ballad, right?
Well, when it starts, there's a little bit of like R&B playing, but I mean the Hijack theme song, which is a real song. I'm just like, so all the filmmakers got together with Apple's budget and they were like, nailed it. this just middle of the road thing is what we want. But that's fine. I mean, the people behind it aren't newbies. Like this guy Jim Field Smith, who directed it and is the creative partners with George Kay, who wrote it. He made a show I loved a few years ago called The Wrong Mans, that James Corden made before he started his late night show. They've worked on a lot of different, they're professionals.
Yeah. Yeah.
You had a quirk that you wanted to point
out. It's not really a quirk, it's just a one of one. It's Idris Elba. It's like,
that's right.
It is, you know, we talk so much about stardom, especially on The Big Picture, where we're like trying to like basically like catalog what is it that makes Tom Cruise running different than this person running? Or what is it that makes Julia Roberts laughing different than this person laughing? Or what is it that this person has that 99.9% of the people in the world don't have?
Yep.
And it's really, really, really difficult to describe. If you could describe it, then you could reverse engineer it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you could take 1,000 different actors and put them in this role and it would be maybe fine, but it wouldn't have been as good. It wouldn't have been as... Why is Idris Elba walking so slow as he approaches the gate?
Yeah.
Like, why does he seem this? Why does he seem that? When he gets up, like, he seems like this. And he has now kind of grown into, I think he's had this for a while, but he has definitely, like, grown into his, like, middle-aged looks and his haggardness a little bit more, because he was, you know, I've read a couple of interviews with him where he's just like, I've aged out of Bond and also that whole discourse left a really bad taste in my mouth, but he's like, I'm too old. I don't want to do that. But he kind of has a later middle-aged, I'm tired vibe that I think really, really works for him.
It's a Harrison Ford thing. It's a Liam Neeson thing. Those guys are obviously much older. But they're like, the getting too old for this shit.
Yeah.
But by the way, I can
gray,
still handle this shit.
A little bit of bags in the eyes. A little bit of like moving slower than I used to.
Did you Google how old he was when you watched the show? I did.
How old?
How old do you think? What's your guess?
54.
50 years young. So he was 49 when he filmed this. So he's... not that much older than your humble narrators.
I didn't say that we weren't. Maybe that's what I'm responding to, is I finally feel seen on screen.
That's what I bring when, you know? When I'm on a plane. That's my energy, too.
I got to say, though, I will pretty much watch anything set in an airport or an airplane
because
there really may be no other environment that I have more opinions about. So just the first half hour of this show is essentially boarding. Mm-hmm. And you might think that that would be boring. Listener, I found that to be the most fascinating mm-hmm. half hour of television I've seen this year, where it's just like, interesting. We're having a little debate about whether overhead baggage mm-hmm. compartments are the property of the community or the individual.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. Also,
this whether or not people with children matter more than people without.
This will surprise no one that, and I don't think this is really a spoiler, but one of the things that happens early on is as you mentioned, Idris is a very casual flyer. No luggage, just saunters onto the plane in the last possible second. And then one of his fellow passengers, who I'm sure is just another innocent person on the plane, doesn't make it in time.
Yeah.
Arrives just as this plane has boarded whatever.
It's literally like a fake rope that she puts up. And she's like, I've put the rope up. Yes. I'm sorry, sir.
And Idris is like, come on, who's it going to harm? And you're like, thank you, McBain. But it will surprise no one to hear that if I had been in that situation, mm-hmm. I would have been like, ma'am, rules are rules. They're here for a reason.
Oh, you don't like anybody boarding late like that? I don't know about you. I'm a real like hovering around the gate. I'm ready to get on.
I cosplay as a military person to get on first.
Yeah.
Like I do not dally. I want everything run shipshape.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I want everyone following all the rules.
Because if the plane somehow gets delayed on the ground, mm-hmm. not that that would ever happen in the United States of America.
Definitely not.
It's not going to like make me feel more or less anxious because I was on the plane for an extra 20 minutes because I lined up like as soon as I could. But if I get on the plane last and, you know, I'm stepping over people, mm-hmm. the overhead bins are all taken, yada, yada. Like, I'm pretty uptight.
Also, everyone's coming up to you, tears in their eyes. Sir, appearance on the Bill Simmons podcast last week was...
Sir. I wanted to tell everybody that I love the idol, but I was scared until I heard you.
You showed leadership. I also know that for narrative purposes, when you have a large airplane and there's over 200 people on it, you cannot humanize everyone. And the people you humanize tend to be very broad strokes.
Well, if maybe Hijack Season 3, we just learn more about everybody.
The tailies?
Yeah.
That worked out great.
Exactly.
I think, but the reason I say that is because it excuses the very broad strokes people that it does show, like the kind of the harried mom or the whatever. It also does excuse the fact that I don't care how many stock footage shots you have of three people being a little concerned about the guns waving around. Like, this is an inaccurate representation of people in 2023 flying and then being hijacked.
Right.
It would not be that chill.
It's not that it's chill. Well, first of all, personally, I was a little bit surprised because I was like, from my experience in Air Force One and other movies.
From your experience in the Air Force.
Guns on a plane are really nerve-wracking because if one bullet hits a window, the entire thing depressurizes.
That's the only reason.
So the idea that they've all got guns is pretty nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Do you think...
But then again, I don't really know how you take over a plane, like strong language. You know what I mean?
Well, you wouldn't be a hijacker. I would never suggest that. But there are a couple tough boys.
I would just be like, "Who? Nobody wants to go to jail tonight, right?
I don't... See, that's my question. I thought that you would be like, we rush them from behind.
No, I'm not doing that.
That wouldn't be you?
No, I would probably try to talk them out of it. I'd be like, what do you guys, whiteboard,
so you're like,
dream big, blue sky, what do you guys need?
You're like Ennis in Die Hard. Like just in word and deed.
Hans, Bobby.
You're just ingratiating yourself to the people. I would say
I would be lying about all my close personal relationships with people. Like the pilot is a bud, he's a bro. Okay, you want to go play?
If it had been,
we can go play Riv when we land in Los Angeles. I promise.
If it had been a bumpy ascent, I don't think there would be any visual difference in me. Like whether it's just like a little turbulence and then a hijacking, I think I would be the
same.
That's
how you feel.
I'd be the same guy.
Yeah.
But look, all of this is to say. Yeah, this is fine. Do this. Like, this, make stuff like this. This is fine.
Yeah.
There should be a middle brow, like, that is entertaining, that ticks boxes. I'm enjoying it.
And lest you think Apple is just churning out mass entertainment for the biggest common denominator, also saw another show that is only made for you.
Yeah, and this is really, this wasn't to call you out, but this is all, like, to put you on the spot, because I don't think you've taken the plunge either into the drops of God.
No.
But...
The only drops of God I recognize are the Righteous Gemstones.
Fair. And I'm behind, so I'm going to catch up on that. instead of catching up, I'm too behind. I watched this show that we talked about on the podcast 6 months ago, where I was like, thank you, Hollywood,
for making one for me. Wait, did you see the third episode of Gemstones?
No, I've only seen the first Goggins? Two. Okay. I've not seen them. And I mentioned it, and then, I don't know, it was almost, I felt like almost self-conscious that there was a show that was just for me. This is, and I didn't watch it, and now I have, and I'm going to continue. I'm just putting you on alert.
Okay.
I'm going to watch the show. This is an Apple, it's an international co-production. It is based on a Japanese manga. Mm. It is a French-Japanese co-pro. And it is about, I wish I could just bottle your face right now and just share it with our listeners.
I know what it's about. I'm just letting you do your bit.
But no, so it's about the daughter of the world's greatest wine expert and connoisseur, who's a Frenchman. She's a French woman. And he, you know, sort of traumatized her in childhood by making her a super taster and like his strong opinions about things. And he abandoned the family, went to Tokyo, wrote all these books, amassed the world's greatest collection of wine, and taught.
He made her a super taster, mm-hmm. had very strong opinions, yes. and then abandoned her and moved to Tokyo.
So are you suggesting this is a potential path for me if camp doesn't start again soon?
That's it.
Frankly, I have no follow-up. Guilty. And in Tokyo, he had like a protege, a student, a young Japanese man who's also, I guess, an exceptional taster of wine, and the father passes away, and then his will is a taste test, basically, like challenging his daughter, with whom he had no contact, and this young Japanese man to basically identify. They have 2 months to identify one wine.
That's my biggest regret about not having kids.
It's just fucking with them from the afterlife.
For not having a will and just being like, guess what, motherfuckers, Squid Game time. You know what I mean?
Well, you could still do it with your friends.
Yeah, but they're not going to participate. You're going to be, like, let's say I die at, like, 64.
Okay.
Okay? You're not going to, at 64, are you going to do Squid Game to get, like, my collection of Larry McMurtry novels?
I could be 65 at that point.
It's true.
So, no, and Idris Elba will only be 69, and he'll still be making these movies. So, he'll win. That's how you do it. You would have it be like, to you, my friend Andy, my other friend Sean Fennessy, and you, Idris Elba.
Yeah, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Please.
To you, I leave.
Compete amongst yourselves.
All the Google Docs of my preparation for the rewatch.
All the remaining Nicorette lozenges in my possession. Anyway, the first episode is kind of humorless, but also it's about wine tasting in Tokyo, uh-huh. So I'm in. And thank you, Apple, for making these things. I still...
There you go.
I still... What a great brand.
Still a brand-friendly
what
guy.
What a great
there.
Brand. I just, you know me. Like, I wish that there was... It's so stratified that, like, would it be fun to see a slightly more creative attempt to make a hijack with a little more humor or something, or a Drops of God with a little self-awareness? Sure, those would be great.
Could there be a little bit more Squid Game in Drops of God?
I think there might be some.
Oh, yeah?
Well, the thing that I didn't mention that the pilot is that the daughter, as a child, like, he was doing the Top Chef quickfire thing where, like, blindfolds her, and then it's just, like... gives her a little taste of things, and she's like, melon, but French. Like, moss. Like, he's feeding his daughter moss.
Okay.
Which seems cool. And, but then as an adult, not only does she not drink, if she tastes alcohol, she has, like, a synesthesia. Like, she explodes in color, and her nose starts bleeding.
Really?
Yeah. It's pretty hype.
Okay. You're talking me into it.
Until I said that her nose starts bleeding, you were uninterested.
I think this will be a show that I check out.
It also does have, you mentioned Squid Game, that one of my favorite genres is interesting and worthwhile shows filming in Asia that also need to find actors who can speak English. Because this show is in three languages, but a lot of it is in English because that's the common language.
Yeah.
And no disrespect to this guy,
like, who Tokyo
might be
Vice too. It's
one
like,
dude might be a genius actor in his native Italian, and he's like the dad's friend who picks her up from the airport, and like, but he has to do all of his acting in English with this French woman, and he was your father, but he was a good friend. Now please enjoy this Spanish Rioja.
Should we break here and have Chris come on?
This Kai, how long have we been talking? Because I think this is...
We're about to hit 30.
Frankly, so this is what a podcast could be.
This is
right?
What it's all about. We watched some television. It's the internal shot clock.
That was amazing, first of all. But also, we've watched some television. Uh-huh. We did a little banter. We talked a couple, you know, state of the industry stuff, and done in 30.
Yeah.
Maybe, Is this what we should have been doing the whole time?
What do you think we usually do?
70?
No, I know, but then he's going to come in and he'll talk for 40 minutes and it will be 70.
We think he's going to talk for 40.
Yeah, what if he's just like, I'm in and out. This is the junket.
It's possible.
Yeah. All right. Christopher Storer is up next.
It's going to be exciting.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from sports exploration and green energy to delivering pizza and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 200, or 2 billion, Atlassian software is built to help keep you connected and moving together as one. This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else. This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client.
Andy and I are so happy to be joined by Chris Storer, the creator of The Bear, director of many of the episodes. He also reinvented the Scott Lick remix of REM's Strange Currencies, as he cracks open
an ice seltzer.
No, make yourself comfortable. Sorry, refresh yourself.
Listen, we like your TV show, but you saved REM. You are very welcome in the studio.
That's very, very nice. Thanks for having me, guys. This is great. Scott Litt remix, though, is awesome.
It's
a real, real heads know kind of cut. You know what I mean? We're going to get into the music of the show, but Andy, you wanted to start.
Yeah, we wanted to talk. Obviously, we want to talk about season two of The Bear, which we adored. But I kind of wanted to start by going backwards a bit, because the impression that we have, and correct me if I'm wrong, was that the production, post-production, and release of season one was kind of like what Carmi and the crew just went through, in the sense that you had an almost impossible deadline, but you made it, and then it was an enormous success. And I kind of wonder if your issue a year ago when all this was going down wasn't too dissimilar from what season three of the show might bring, in that, like, you did it once, and how the hell are you going to do it again? So it's July. You did do it again. Season two is incredible.
Thanks, man.
Going back to that time a year and a half ago or so, how did you approach the second season of the show? Because you had the added weight of expectations, and I don't think you had any extra time. They still wanted you to hit like an old-fashioned TV show. They wanted you to be on the air again. So how were you so prepared to make the show that you ended up making?
The whole thing's pretty wild, because I think the one plus of all of it was that FX very smartly kind of made us flesh out what the world sort of was.
Yeah.
And obviously, I think in any show that you're starting off, that's a key step. But I think Joanna and I found that we were able to put together what we thought were like, oh, this is probably what 1, 2, and 3 would look like, as like a roadmap of where we were going. And it's funny, because when we were shooting the pilot, I think everyone at FX was like, this is kind of nuts. But we see that it's cool, and you're sort of thrown into this world. And we shot that, I think, in the summer of 2021. So it was still, like, COVID was still really in the mix. And I think it was interesting because I think on season two, we were sort of like, oh, that was the first time we saw that person with their mask off or got to really like hang out with them, because that bubble was obviously pretty protective. And I think when we were making it, it felt fun and alive. And like Maddie and I would always say, like, we think this is really cool. But I think we had both been a part of shows or movies that we really loved and no one saw.
This is Maddie Matheson.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we were like, I do think somebody will find this and think it's cool. And I think once we finally got picked up and I think, let's see, we started shooting February 28th of 2022 and then it was on June 23rd.
That's the thing that I feel like people cannot comprehend.
Well, you know what's weird, man, is that it was actually kind of the best thing that happened because it just removes second guessing and it does feel like you're running a restaurant.
Yeah.
And but it also put a lot of pressure, I think, on our cast to really like step up. And I think, you know, you asked like, how's it feel like going to with expectations and then everything? And it's like, I genuinely feel like I wish I could take more credit. I think 95% of what people like about the show is the chemistry with the cast. Mm-hmm, and I think it's because they are such wonderful. I mean, they're the best, dude. And I love them all so much. And I think even casting it was a trip because, you know, a majority of them were my dear friends in real life. So it was like, I love them and they kind of love each other. So I feel like you'll feel that on screen a little bit.
So you knew a lot of the cast.
Yeah, I think it was interesting. The first two people that were like cast were Io and Lionel. And like Jeremy was always going to, we always wanted Jeremy, but it was that weird period where he was coming off Shameless and we didn't know if that was going
to
go
again.
Yeah,
I remember talking to him after season one. He was like, I didn't know if I wanted to do another show.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting to think about that he spent, you know, 13 seasons on a show, which now seems unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
So when we finally got that, it was like those three were together and like Liza, my girlfriend, had worked with previously. And so like all these things dialed, like the true X factor was Eben. Like Richie was the hardest person to cast because it's so specific. And I'll never forget, like we did a chemistry read with Eben and Jeremy. And I think Eben was in the middle of shooting Andor, but like couldn't talk about what he was doing.
But he had some cool tattoos.
Well, no, he looked, I mean, it was so interesting.
Greedo's blaster in his tote bag.
Yeah, like the first time I saw Eben do this, he was in some sort of like shanty in a part of the world that was not immediately identifiable.
Yeah, Burbank. No.
No, but like literally like with like mountains behind him. And we were like, where? And I'm like, this dude is inherently the guy, like already, like he's got it. And then their chemistry was just great, but he was also wearing like a tank top and just came at it 100 miles per hour. And it sort of made Jeremy bounce back at him. And they instantly felt like brothers. So it was a real trip to do that. And then I think when we were shooting it, the schedule really informed, I think, the fast pace of the show.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that was really great, like our crew also doesn't get enough credit for being incredible. Like they really are. I mean, everyone from our camera department to our art department to our makeup, props, everybody. And we were able to keep the same schedule every day, which was essentially like shoot all the scenes from like 7 a.m. to 3:30. And then 3:30 to 5:30 was like the food inserts, which is always kind of the thing that sucks. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and it's amazing to have like my sister and Maddie on hand to sort of handle that.
And
with
they
the
like
prop
do
scene.
The omelet and do the chips and stuff
Well, Io did the omelet.
Okay. Wow.
And that was amazing. Like pretty cool because I think she worked really hard on it. It's like, you know, it's like sort of, there's a lot of loving references to all of our chef friends in the show. And that one in particular was kind of like a riff on Ludo's omelet at Petit Trois, and who, you know, was great to my sister. And
your sister, Courtney, who's a great cook in her own right and chef at John and Vinny's.
Yes.
And
one of our producers. And I think she was able to sort of be like, okay, we wanted to do this. And what's, you know, how would Sydney sort of personalize that? And it's one thing to make that, like, when you're in my sister's kitchen, but then when there's, like, 100 crew people, like, looking at you, so
yeah.
I had a lot of pressure on her. She nailed it, dude.
So Andy was asking you about expectations, and I have something that kind of goes along with that, which is really about when a TV show goes from being, you know, something in your head and something that's shared among the crew and cast that you're making it to almost, like, a kind of more public ownership.
Yeah.
And I've compared The Bear a couple of times to Friday Night Lights.
That's cool, man.
Not only in some of the tonal stuff and maybe even some of the filmmaking stuff, but like especially like the way in which I notice people talk about the characters and feel protective of the characters and start to develop like almost like personal relationships with some of the characters. But with that comes, they're still characters.
Yeah.
You still want to put them through certain things and they can't just be preserved and always, you know, internet boyfriend for everybody. But like, did you have any moments in the making of or the writing of Two where you were starting to become aware of, like, this is what people think of Richie or Sydney or Carmi?
Not once.
Okay.
And I think it's because, again, we had, like, since we sort of have one season one, two, and three figured out, it was really cool to not have to answer any of that stuff, really, you know? And I think, again, I think it just goes back to, I mean, Andy, you know, in production, like, you just get beat up all day. Everyone's just, you know, like, your time is always just, you're obsessed with time. So it's like any of that stuff sort of just gets covered in everything else that has to happen in the day.
If you had had more time, maybe then the doubt would start to creep.
I think so. And or maybe, or...
Or if the season had been delayed
longer. Yeah, less doubt, but more like, you know, Jeremy said this thing that was really interesting is in the aftermath when you're like promoting it, the cool thing about the show, like, love or hate it, like, it, there are, people do feel attached to certain aspects of it, and I think take certain things away from performances that maybe the actors weren't even aware of. Like, Jeremy was like, man, I've been talking about it so much, I don't even remember where, what my first instincts of the character were. And I think it's one of the cool things, again, what I say about, like, 95% of it is the cast. It's like, they're bringing a lot of their own personality to it. And I think it just speaks to how incredible they are, that you just get attached to it. And the Friday Night Lights comparison is awesome. I love that show so much, man.
But there's also, you know, and I clearly you had committed to this ahead of time, so you didn't want to rethink it, but it's a radically different show in the second season in some crucial ways. I mean, it goes from being sort of knock around blue collar to white linen, or at least white linen aspirational in terms of the construct of what they're doing. And you have to have some confidence, right, in the overall story, but also what need, I guess the question in there is, you are committed to a radical change in the show from season one to season two before you even went into production on season one. How did you keep perspective on what you needed to hold on to? Like, what are your North Stars in terms of what makes the bear, even as the restaurant itself changes?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it was also like me just wanting to be honest to why I made it in the first place, you know? And I think it's, because to me, it's less about a restaurant and more about sort of these people. Mm-hmm. And I knew, you know, I knew we were going to be slower to start and you were going to open up the world and get to know these people. But I also kept thinking, like, dude, if it's just people screaming at each other, you're going to get sick of that shit.
Yeah.
Like, truly selfishly. Like, I was like, I don't know if I want to, like, shoot scenes like that all day long. And it's like, you know, there's so many references to other filmmakers I love that we were sort of like, it's cool to change it up a little bit and, like, let these people sort of play around and get to know them. But at the same time, like, we know it's going to get crazier again at some point. And I think, like, you might maybe enjoy it a little bit more because you haven't been bludgeoned with people, you know, screaming for 10 more episodes.
Yeah, I saw you talking about, like, the Hornsby song in the opening episode being like, it's okay, chill out. It's going to be, like, we're gonna take it, like, down, like, 5 degrees here.
Totally.
You know?
And I also think that's true of, like, not just restaurants, but a lot of jobs. Like, it goes from chaos to not chaos. Yeah. And I think in season two, because they're building a restaurant, it sort of felt natural to let them chill out a little bit. And I think, yeah, that Hornsby song is great, dude. I mean, it's so funny because it was like, you know, so much of the show obviously is based on, you know, friendships I made at Mr. Beef and my buddy Chris Zucchero. And I remember, you know, being, like 5 years old or something and hearing about Backdraft filming in Chicago.
Yeah.
And Backdraft always has, like, such a specific place in my heart. And there's this great montage that has that Bruce Hornsby song on it. Like, it's really sort of lovely in the middle of this movie of them sort of driving around
Chicago. Yeah, that's like they're doing, it's like all their, like, they're firefighting and it's just like a beautiful summer in Chicago.
Yeah, yeah.
I watched a live performance of that after the show came out. I was like, I have not thought about Bruce Hornsby a lot.
I thought you had a live performance of Backdraft.
I did. A live performance,
during the strike, we're all trying to make ends meet.
And Russell and Billy Baldwin
dinner theater.
Getting back together.
It gets kind of exciting. But there's a, it's a Bruce Hornsby in the Range concert from like 1990. And it
Where was it at?
I think it's in Chicago.
That's awesome.
I'm not sure. But it's like, it starts and it's Hornsby and I'm familiar with him. And I'm like, I wonder what Bruce Hornsby's band looked like. And it pans right. And it's like, it's a time in America where dudes were, like, just way older.
Very specific,
You know,
they're, like, 40, but they look 70.
They're 40, but they look like they just definitely have smoked, like, 700 Benson and Hedges that day. And they're just, like the session dudes who are playing with them are just amazing.
I also blew Chris's mind. I was like, have you been keeping up with Hornsby? So you've been making some pretty relevant records recently.
Oh, yeah, man.
He's fucking sending me, like, late period Hornsby songs.
Yeah, Hornsby has a duet with James Mercer from the show. It's good. Look. We
he still got it.
We'll circle back.
Hornsby still got it.
Still got it.
End of podcast.
100%.
There's an interesting dynamic that happens with long-running TV shows, and it speaks to what Chris was saying about people's parasocial relationship to the characters, which is we love these people. And I think one of the things that makes the Bear so special is that it's clear that you love them also, you and Joanna and the rest of your creative team. Yeah. You love them as actors and you love them as characters. Yeah. How do you consider your responsibility towards them when you're crafting a season like season two, where you want them to win? Yeah. And there are moments that are, you know, frankly, why we watch television, like when Tina smiles,
yeah,
when Sydney offers her the job, you know, and it's also why you cast an actress like Liza Colon-Zayas, because yeah, she's in the background and she can give you that smile, mm-hmm, and do so much more. But so just in terms of that balancing act of you want to give them wins, but it's also a dramatic TV show with very high, mm-hmm, stakes. What's your setting on that?
It's interesting. Me, Coco, and Maddie always have this thing that we talk about a lot, which is like winning is losing a lot of the times.
Yeah.
And it's hyper specific to restaurants, which is like one service will be great. Mm-hmm. The next day can be fucked. Can I swear? I'm so sorry.
Yes. Please. Oh, in fact, you're
like,
encouraged.
Yeah. No, but like the next day will just be fucked. You know, and it's like, you sort of see that in the building of the restaurant because, you know, like the construction and sort of building of any business can be relatively boring. But I think when you know how much stock these people have in it, even like the smallest victories kind of end up being these gigantic game changers. Like,
yeah,
for example, like I remember talking to a lot of my friends that were opening new restaurants or something, and they were always saying like fire suppression and getting the gas on is always like the heartbreaker.
Mm-hmm. I said when we were doing our season breakdown, I was like, 8 is like a shadow end of the season, because for them, that's when their lives flash before their eyes,
yeah,
you know, and it's like,
yeah,
then the hard part happens. But yeah, there's like a nice version of this where it's like, we passed the test, the end of the season.
Totally. And yeah, I think it's interesting too, because at that episode, you know, you end like with fire and then we end the season with like cold, and it's sort of back to this, yeah, like fight, flight, and then the third response of stress, which is freeze, which I think is extremely relatable to a lot of people. But I think when you put that in the scope of trying to operate a new business and be a leader to whatever your skill set is, like the smallest victories are everything, man, because the biggest victories are often the ones that you lose, I think. And I think that's sort of a little bit of the sort of the outline we always follow when we're putting together a season.
You know, the person who really has to hold the L in this second season is Carmi, right? Like,
yeah,
the character is the one that even, you know, you get Richie's sort of redemptive moments when he's staging. You get Sydney kind of coming to this sort of point of understanding with her father, you know, all these characters kind of find themselves in a new, maybe like place that they've been longing, yeah, to be. And then he's fucking locked in a freezer, unable to experience joy, and now, mm-hmm, single again, or, you know, and just at least obviously it has this like terrible moment with Claire. That's got to be an interesting conversation with Jeremy, because it's like, you don't get like Carmi doesn't get to come in and do the carousel speech in Mad Men. Like, yeah, you know what I mean? He doesn't get to come in and be like, tonight I cooked my ass off and everybody saw it as the best in the world. But like, he seems like the kind of actor who embraces that.
100%.
But you would have to have that, because there might be other people out there who'd be like, can I do something really cool at the end of the season?
Yeah.
Like everybody else gets to, like, can I drive around a love story? Like,
no, it's a great point. Cause I also think, like, I should also say, like, Jeremy's an incredibly gracious actor who, like, even when I like told him, you know, I think this is what's going to happen, he's like, that's so fucking cool. Because also you get to know everybody else. But I do think it is true of a lot of people. It's definitely something I suffer with, where you're just like, I'm going to freeze and can't accept any form of joy.
Yeah.
I can't, like, this is like, you know, when Joanne and I were sort of roadmapping like one and a two and a three, like she was like, when was the last time you had like fun? And I was sort of like, whoa. Like, it was one of those moments, yeah, that I was like, and I am grateful and I love my job,
yeah,
in my life very much, but like there were, I was like, I don't know.
College?
Well, no, but it is interesting because you're
sort
of like,
class on fun. I audited it.
No, really. But it is this thing where you're sort of like, well, I have a great time at work and I love everybody, but there is that moment when, you know, you're on location and you get home and your place is all of a sudden very quiet.
Yeah.
And, you know, your significant other isn't there and you're sort of out of your routine. And it's like one of the first things we see in episode one, too. It's like Jeremy going home to, mm-hmm, quiet. And,
yeah,
I think that's the moment that sort of says a lot about where he is in his life, especially someone that grew up knowing chaos is the norm. So when you have this, mm-hmm, girl come into your life that sort of represents maybe even like hope and something about
acceptance,
patience,
yeah,
and acceptance, yeah, and like kindness, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
I think one of the most obvious challenges that you face in making the show broadly, but specifically the second season, I think, is sort of convincing the world that fine dining is worthwhile, even in this economy, right. That there's a reason for doing this. And I think the brilliant way that you choose to communicate that is why these specific characters need that, yeah. Right? You know, they need that order and chaos. And I think that's an interesting through line for the show's project as a whole, which is it is deeply, I guess I keep using the word credulous, of the idea that you can find yourself through work, yeah. Through repetition, through self-respect, and these sort of overarching concepts that people who successfully navigate kitchens
right.
Preach. I mean, is that a fair assessment?
100%, man. I mean, look, I'm like a hyper-anxious person. Like, anxiety is a real thing in depression that I battle with all the time. And I think one of the things that I have found that sort of helps at times is routine. Mm-hmm. And I think that is true of a lot of creative people I know. And I think because the first season of the show was more intense and about this guy trying to figure out his life, and season two, we sort of get to get into like what creativity means to people and what
yeah.
Teamwork means to people. And like, I don't know that a Michelin rated restaurant is better than like, I think that's like a conversation I don't have the answer to, but I do think there is something about the value of teamwork and being pushed and finding yourself creatively and how that can lead to better communication in your own life. Like, I think you were asking about process earlier, like, it sounds like bullshit, but like, I am so grateful for this show, man. Like, it's like in terms of the communication with my partners and like we have a good time, man. Like, we're all considerate of each other, and like, it does feel like a family thing. And I know that it's not necessarily always that way. So I think, you know, when you were saying like, how do we react to season one? I think the thing we really did was sort of like, all right, aside from what people thought of it, believe me, like, you can go on Twitter and enough people fucking hate it that it's all good. But I do think when you look back at like, well, why did it, what did we do that was right? And, yeah. You know, there were some, like, whether it was like setting up the prop department and art department or how they pushed certain ideas or, you know, how Maddie and Coco furthered the story through the food. Like, we just locked in on some things that we thought were sort of kind of special. And we were like, well, that could lend itself a little bit more to season two.
I was curious whether or not, you know, this second seasons of shows, especially shows that are like relatively successful or successful in any way, tend to follow this idea that you take this core group of people and then you necessarily, for narrative purposes, have to separate them. They have to go on like these individual journeys and then bring them back together in some way, which this show does do. But I also noticed that there was a little bit of a departure filmmaking wise in various episodes, specifically, you know, I would say Pop had like a kind of almost Cameron Crowe feel. Yeah. And obviously the Richie episode, like, a lot of people have talked about like the Michael Manniness of it. And, you know, so as a filmmaker and as somebody who's probably overseeing like the visual aspect of this show, was it important for you to have like almost like the filmmaking journey be different than the first season and go off and try other things and then come back to the bear in those last two episodes?
I think so. But I also think it was more, you know, if we were doing a lot of the same camp, it's kind of the same as the yelling thing. Like, I was like, if we were doing some of the same camera stuff, like, I think it might get repetitive and ultra boring. But also, like, storytelling wise, I kept thinking, like, you know, they're in a little bit of a brighter spot. So, like, you know, Andrew Wade, our DP, and Chris Dame and Gary Maloof, our camera operator, they really, and Jeremy Long, our one of our gaffers, like, they really built sort of a brighter space. So, like, the bear is inherently going to be a little bit of a brighter space. But also, you know, what we would find, like, I wish I could tell you that it was, like, all well thought out in advance, but it really kind of comes from character. Like, episode 7, for example, like, we had so much fun thinking that, like, Eben or Richie was obsessed with Ridley Scott and Michael Mann.
Yeah.
So we were like, we're going to lend some of that to that episode. And then we have, like, you know, the wonderful Molly Gordon join us this year. And I think, like, the first time that I saw her and Jeremy together, it was like, okay, we're going to have a 100 millimeter lens and that's it. And, like, we're just going to let these, like, both of their eyes are so sharp and hopeful and full of promise. It's like, let's just let them look at each other and we don't have to overcover it. But I think we also knew that because Joanna, like, Pop is one of my favorite episodes of this season. I think Joanna just, like, killed that thing because I feel like it's been a while since we've seen just, like, an old, kind of like an older romantic comedy that's sort of, and by the way, talking about music, the one music cue that no one's picked up on Claire and Carm, when they're in the kitchen toward the end of the party, we got Ira Newborn's Weird Science score that's playing like very, very quietly in the background. Because it's like Joanna had that great idea too, that the party should sort of just feel like it's a representation of childhood and there's like Super Dog all over the place. And
I like the idea of somebody at Disney who's like in the accounting department being like, okay.
I think FX has just been incredible partners with that stuff. They're like, all right, man, you want a Hornsby song? Like, I get it, you know. But I think like the same goes for like episode 3, which Joanna directed, that really was about creativity.
Yeah.
And, you know, her and Io got to run around Chicago, and so many of our restaurant friends like Donnie Medea and everybody at Kasama really helped us sort of inform what that creative process is like. And then, you know, for episode 4, Rami directed it.
Yeah.
And Newport Barrow, who shot our pilot, came back, and we knew it would have a different look. And I think it's because Joanna and I are usually directing, and Rami and I have worked together so much in the past, that it was like, you guys do, like, just make this its own thing. Because we also know there's going to be a bomb in episode 6 that's going to be kind of nutty. So
I think we want to talk about 6 and 7, but I did want to ask you just two questions about casting. You sort of alluded to it before. Part of it is something you've already said, which I hadn't realized, that you had relationships with some of the actors.
Yeah.
One thing that I feel is kind of you can make this blanket statement, just like filmmakers broadly love actors, but I feel like there's some who really fucking love actors, and I get that sense from your show. And the reason I say that is not just because you cast so well, but you and your collaborators seem to just see into the actor's soul and think about what they excel at, what particular ineffable thing they bring, and put them in positions to succeed. And I can't help but always think of Eben when I consider that, you know, because you, in his performance, I see decades of never quite being the guy, even though, you know, we've had him on the podcast. He's a lovely person, but he brings that to it. And I can't help but think about it when you have him share the screen with Olivia Colman, you know, who is world-class actor, and she's there doing one scene and she's doing it with him, and that guy can fucking hang.
Yeah.
And you're giving him the opportunity to do it, and he shows up on center court at Wimbledon to have that match.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting too, man, because I do, like, I really am in awe of them. And I think, you know, the way we shoot our show, it's like 2 or 3 takes for the most part, because I think we like it to feel nervous, and especially sometimes with the cooking stuff, like take 4 almost feels a little too
dialed. Yeah, they're almost too good at it. Yeah.
But I think this thing, and again, like, it's kind of the film school of season 2, which is like you really feel some of the actors unlock each other or take them to the next level. Like, for example, when early on I was like, Io, I think we're going to see your dad this year. And I was like, and I was thinking before I could even say it, she was like, Robert Townsend. Oh, and I was like, holy fuck.
Yeah.
Not only because Robert Townsend rules, but it's like, you know, Io and him, it had a friendship, but also like, you know, I love directing comedy specials. Like, it's something that I really like doing a lot. And Robert was always someone I really admired. Like, he made Raw, but he also made Meteor Man and the 5 Heartbeats. And when I was like, I don't know if he'll do it. And when we talked to him about it, and we were lucky enough to have him, like, him and I would just unlock something in each other, man. Mm-hmm. Where you're like, you guys feel like you've known each other forever. And I think the same is true of Molly and Jeremy, but also Eben and Bernthal, dude. Like, I mean, like Eben obviously is a world-class actor, but like, because him and Johnny have had this history and are dear friends in real life, there's like something about the two of them that they just keep going.
You can't fake it.
Yeah, I mean—
No, there's stuff like he looks at Bernthal in those scenes where he's like, he wants his like approval, and, but it's never written. It's just like him 100%. Like, hey man, did you hear my joke? Like, kind of like, it's so good.
Yeah, and then I also think you see like Will Poulter and Lionel have this chemistry that's out of control. And speaking to the Olivia thing was really interesting, because I think when we were talking about that episode, you know, like, you're going to see who the chef is eventually at the end. And, you know, she's sort of based on sort of like, you know, like a Thomas Keller or someone that's like bases themselves off routine and has gotten their ass kicked in the industry a little bit and come back. And we kept thinking like, man, there's something so cool. Not only that, if the reveal that it's a woman and she sort of looks like Nancy Silverton and kind of has like a great vibe, but a British woman, you know, we were like, man, if Olivia Colman would do it, we'd really hammer that thing home. And we were lucky to get her. And I think
how much time did you have with her?
So she's like the coolest person on the face of the earth. I mean, like, it's so weird because you never know what you're. And I have to say, like, every guest actor that came in this year was like the shit, dude.
Yeah.
Like, truly, like, working for scale, like no one got paid, like came in for 3 days at a time. That, you know, we kicked the shit out of them and it was the most fun. And I think Olivia flew from London for 12 hours and we shot her out in about 2.5 hours and then she went home.
Christ.
Yeah. But I mean, I think for newcomers to the set, they're sort of, at first they're kind of like, this is kind of wild. And then they're like, oh, this is so fun and so cool.
Well, that's a perfect segue to the other question, which was, one of the things that the show has done so well is bring people into the world who feel like they've always been in the world. And obviously part of that is people that you knew would fit in. Part of that is casting people who might be unknown to the larger public so that when we begin to know them, we know them for this part. So Molly Gordon's a great example where I think I've seen her in mm-hmm. things, but I don't know her. And she looks, and she's lovely to look at, but she also looks like she could be in Chicago. It's plausible.
Right.
That was kind of a weird drive-by in Chicago. I apologize.
No, that
makes a city full of beautiful people. As a Philadelphian, I can say that. But she fits. And so I was curious about the thinking behind Six, where suddenly there you've brought in this rogues gallery of brilliant performers, some of whom are like Twitter faves, you know, or just like people who we have deep connections to and feel a certain way about. The decision to do that and whether it would disrupt anything, and then also, I think you've already begun to say what that was like when you were actually rolling on them.
Well, you know, it's interesting because we wanted it. First of all, that episode was so fun because when you write something, or when, you know, Joe and I wrote that together, and obviously it's like very deeply personal of some shit that we had seen. And I think a lot of people have seen when you just have a holiday dinner that just goes to shit and everyone's trying too hard and there's probably some substance abuse and some mental illness. But as gnarly as it gets, there's also stupid shit happening everywhere. Like, you know, like something can be really particularly disgusting in one room and then silly in the other. And I think when we were putting that together, we really wanted it to feel disorientating and disruptive and distracting. The way that you walk into a holiday party, and you're sort of like, who the fuck is that? Like, what's that person doing? Like, what is going on? Like, why is Bob Odenkirk? Why is Jamie Lee Curtis here? Like, what's going on? But then as you settle into it, you're sort of like, oh, these are all heavy hitters throwing fastballs at each other.
Yeah.
And I think for me, selfishly, it was also this chance to be like, okay, we have to remember all these people. Same, not too dissimilar from Bernthal in season one, where these people are a weight on Carmi or in some cases like the savior to them. So when I look at somebody like Sarah Paulson, who I think is one of the greatest actors working today, that she came in and did that for us. And she was sort of this person that get to give a key piece of advice to Jeremy. Like that makes as much sense to me as like Jamie Lee just being a fucking animal.
Because they need to be outsized, 100%. Not just in terms of casting, but outsized in terms of the 100%. Shadow they cast.
Like,
on
this
our
is
lead.
Someone that they loom over Jeremy every day.
It's so crazy. The Stevie and Michelle characters were like, I remember when I was like in fourth or fifth grade, but like my grandfather died, and my aunt came to the funeral from LA with this dude who was her boyfriend, and he like immediately the first day took me out and bought me a skateboard. And that's the only thing I remember about my grandfather's like entire thing. Like, was like this guy who was like the coolest motherfucker ever bought me a Veriflex when I was like 9 years old. And like, that's Michelle and Stevie. Like they're the people from out of town who are just like, we got out of here, you know? And they're like a little cool and their words carry so much weight because they've got this experience outside of this nest, you know?
100%. But also it's like exactly what you said. Like you're anticipating this guy to be a fucking dick and he brings a skateboard. You're like, oh, he's all right.
Yeah.
And I think like when we were, the other thing that we'd like to do on our show a lot is sort of like, or just in general, I should say, is like there is a little bit of a reversal to it. Like where you're like, I think Mulaney is so fucking good on that episode.
He's incredible.
And like, and I think like people just hadn't seen him do that yet. And I think when you really look at it, you're like, well, he's one of our greatest storytellers. Like, why wouldn't he be good in this scenario having to make a speech? But also at the same time, you're like, I haven't seen JLC go fucking batshit crazy like that. Like, I haven't seen sort of like Gillian do that with Eben. Like, I haven't seen a lot of the people in this. Like, by the way, Ricky Stafiri, who's one of our best friends and was our assistant on season one, plays Ted Fack and fucking rules. And like, his first, I mean, like, it was so great because he's like, dude, my first scene, I'm in between Odenkirk and Bernthal.
Yeah.
And like and it was so funny because I think the first thing we shot, one of the first things we shot of this episode was like Paulson hanging with the facts. And I think for a second she's like, what in the fuck is happening? And like dove right in and it was the best.
How do you balance with so many, I want to say like just talented actors. I want to say big actors, but I didn't mean that in a pejorative
way. No, I know what you mean.
But as a director, you are kind of a chef in this moment because you have to calibrate the ingredients to taste. Yeah. So what is the tone that you're striking on set to make sure that while they go big, this is a holiday dinner, people are high, they're drunk, they're angry, they stay within the bounds of the meal you're trying to serve?
Well, it was interesting too, because when we wrote the script, I think the script is like 35 pages. And I think the end of the episode is about 105. Mm-hmm. And that's like a hard thing too, because I hate when, sometimes shows go too long. Mm-hmm. But I think like on this one, we kind of earned it a little bit and it didn't feel boring to us. And I know we go a little bit above 30 a few times a season, but in the thinking about it, like the way I think we love to run our sets is like, here's sort of the script, but like, let's add or subtract and like, let's kind of end here. And I think the biggest bonus of having actors like that, dude, because I know some people were like, were you scared? And you're like, no, dude, you're like pumped because you're like, you know that this is going to get fucking crazy. But yeah. And it's like, as we were shooting that, and like Bob's the best, dude. And I think like when we were shooting that scene at the table, there was just like one of my favorite moments of shooting anything. I think we had done two takes that was just sort of the fork throwing kind of starting to build up and everyone getting tense. And I think like Bernthal knew that we usually do about three. And so in between two and three, he like walked up and he was like, boss, I'm gonna throw this fucking table. I was like, throw that table, my dude. So like, but it was great. And I also think like that episode in particular was great because, you know, Io wasn't in it. So she served as she produced that episode with us. And she was on set with me at the monitor with me and Joanna. And, you know, Io is going to be like probably one of our finest filmmakers. She's just so sharp.
She's already one of our preeminent Letterboxd users.
Yeah. I mean, dude, she's smart in a way that's kind of.
Her reviews are great. Like, yeah.
But I mean, she just is so literate and sharp at all times that I think like having her at the monitor, like she was the person that was like rein this in a little bit, or, you know, or Joe or anyone or Josh Sr. would chime in and sort of be like, let's take this down a notch. But I think the benefit of having all those people was it was going to get out of fucking control. Like, so many things weren't scripted. Like when Sarah looks at Jamie Lee and is like, not really.
Oh shit.
That like, fuck you explosion was really incredible because at the same time, like I know our core cast is so like, I think it should also go without saying that like Abby's sort of the MVP of the season, sneaky. Yep. And I think like that performance of that episode is sort of grounds everything. Like that last shot we see of her is, cause there was a take where she was crying and it was like, there was something better about the exhaustion sort of being at the end of all this crazy shit. And again, going back to the unlocking thing, like they all worked so well together, man. Like, cause I think you were also saying like when you get more known people, maybe this shit hits the fan or, you know, maybe someone's a dick or something, you know, but everyone was the best.
But also there's an act of faith to it too. I'm glad you mentioned Abby because, you know, she was an important part of the ensemble in season one, but you know, she didn't have her own arc, or we didn't understand how she fit in. And there is an enormous act of faith. You know, I overdo the, like, the show is the metaphor for the creative process.
Sure, sure.
But when Carmi gives Tina his knife, I mean, you could go one of two ways. You could just run away from something that's an unknown. Can Abby carry those moments? Can she do these scenes? Can she be the integral part of the cast? Or you trust the people you hired, the people you've come to know, right? And it seems like that was enormously rewarding for everyone.
Of course, man. And also, I think it's like, it goes back to that like generosity of everybody. Like the cast is so kind to each other and really wants everyone to succeed. And I think like a lot of the most alive moments. I think that's what I should have said. Like, we're always chasing things that feel like really, really alive. Like, one of my favorite moments of a movie semi-recently is in American Hustle. This is like such a bizarre reference to make, but like, there is a moment in American Hustle where Bradley Cooper thinks he's won and does an impression of Louis C.K., gets a laugh, and then does it again. Which, like, whatever you think of that movie is like truly one of the fucking greatest things ever, because you know that was improv and you know that he was set up to sort of create that moment. And I think like that spirit really is what we were sort of chasing in episode six, because as you said, Andy, like everything else is so sort of locked down the rest of the season. Like this is where we could sort of fully be out of control.
I was wondering for six specifically, but in general, how much of the filmmaking do you think we should be viewing? I mean, you wouldn't do prescriptive stuff for an audience, but is how much of six, for instance, is like Carmi's memory and like the filmmaking kind of is reflecting this is this pivotal moment in this guy's life. This is why he needs to make this cannoli or can't make this cannoli. But also like it's an inflection point. He goes away again after this. Everything changes. And so that the way the performances are calibrated, but specifically the filmmaking is, he's not in every scene,
right?
But I almost watched that episode. I'm like, this is this guy's memory of this night to some extent.
100%.
And how much does that impact? Like, so even, you know, even when he meets Claire in the deli or the bodega or whatever, and it's like, that is like the fucking most romantic thing you've ever seen. It's just this frosted freezer window. Mm-hmm. And it's like the idea that you're shooting kind of to reflect the interiority of these characters.
100%. Yeah. I also think it's like, you know, chefs talk a lot about sense memory. So that episode really is, it's all noise. It's, and then in the middle of it, it's sort of shot like The Bear. It's sort of shot like you remember first season, but you know, Claire and Carmen at the fridge, we framed and shot that the same way that Jamie Lee in Carm are at the fridge, the same way that we shot Carm and Bernthal in the, you know, so the these things reverberate. And also, like, I think if you remember in season two or in episode two, there's a moment where they have to like cut a lock only for Carmy to be locked away at the end. Like, there are these things about getting locked in these memories and being, like I said before, like there's flight, fright, and then freeze, which is like a really hard thing to talk about, but also like visualize. And so I think when Carm looks back on that, like, we also colored it differently. Like, it's much grainier. It's as close to 30. Like, we wanted to shoot 35, and it's we ran into some production.
Yeah.
Well, we just couldn't. I don't think we could have been able to move.
Succession had used all the 35mm film.
Yeah. Well, also,
budget got blown on Coleman's flight.
No, yeah. We were also just like, you know, the schedule was so fast that we were like, we got to keep rocking.
They're like, you can have Weird Science, or you can have 35mm film.
Literally, you can have Strange Currencies three times, or you know this. But you know, we also like, I think one of the things we figured out about the show is that we normally shoot really long takes.
Uh-huh.
So we'll just roll for 12 minutes and have people sort of come in and out of the scene. And, you know, that first scene in six where they're all in the kitchen was truly like the funnest thing. Cause you're like, okay, Gil, you come in here, Eben, like go tickle Jamie Lee, let her fall. Like, and it started to feel alive and sort of scary in the way that memories can feel sort of alive and scary and also faded a little bit.
I think, you're in a safe space when it comes to episode seven, Forks, because I think we both think it's a masterpiece.
Oh, that's nice,
we
man.
Love it. And particularly coming after six, the economy of it is really bracing and exciting. And and there's just clearly, you give a lot of thought to how you course out the season. But I did want to use seven as an opportunity to get your thoughts on one criticism that I have heard about the season. I don't share it. I actually think it's a feature, not a bug, but that there's a fantasy element here.
Yeah.
That Richie, who the Richie we meet in season one, could he become a world-class three-star Michelin maitre d' after a week?
Yeah.
You know, is he uniquely special to have this opportunity granted to him and to deliver in that moment? And I feel like that's something you must have considered in the storytelling.
Totally.
And I'm wondering what your perspective on that is.
You know, it's interesting because a lot of that episode was sort of inspired by some of my friends that do this, that run three-star Michelin restaurants. And like Nick Kokonis at Alinea was really great to us and let us watch Expo. And particularly my friend Will Gadara wrote a book about hospitality, and he wrote...
Richie's reading that.
Richie is reading, but... and he also ran 11 Madison, was a co-owner of 11 Madison Park. And because, you know, some people are like, you know, well, that was so quick. And it's like, well, I don't know how long excitement, passion takes. Like, who knows? Like, by the way, Richie could fall on his ass in season three. But I think the thing that I wanted to capture was, man, when you're inspired, whether it's by a job or a girl or something happening in your life, dude, like, it's the best. Especially with someone who's been struggling with purpose, and especially someone who's like, this shit is so stupid, only to find that like, oh, I kind of understand it. Like, I kind of am into this. Like, taking care of people is like a beautiful thing. Cause again, like, we don't know what happens in season three. Like, we don't know if it pans out for him, if he ends up loving it. But I do think when you are inspired in the right way, something clicks. And I think like the every second counts really means something to a guy like Richie.
Well, I also just think fundamentally, like, the core tenet of your show is that it's very big hearted.
Yeah.
You know, it is not ironic. It is not, there's no distance. And I think that's underappreciated, and I think it's one of the reasons why people respond to it to such a degree. And you can see it in, you know, in a character arc like the one we're describing, but I think you can also see it, and we've talked about this a lot, with the needle drops.
Sure.
You know, when you put Let Down in season one,
totally.
I was like, these motherfuckers. Like, you don't actually use the best song. You have to like hide behind it, and you put the obscure track on the mixtape
to
impress someone. You don't use the one that will actually bring the house down.
Totally.
You guys always choose the song that is the biggest, purest expression of what people might be feeling or thinking or wanting to listen to.
Yeah. Well, it's your show. You should answer the question.
No, but it's great because I think it's also like, you know, Josh and I do the music and we work with a clearance person. It's great. And we sort of have really found like the turnaround again, back to process is so fast that I think every season we sort of be like, all right, here's some music that we were feeling previously, and particularly driving around listening to XRT and radio station XRT in Chicago that I love, which sort of just plays anything and everything. But it sort of also is in the place where you're like, I don't, if I was just going on what this station played, I wouldn't know what decade it was.
Yeah, right.
And I think by having all these needle drops from all over the place, it does feel a little timeless and a little dad rocky and a little like sort of lost somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you were worried about losing us in season two, you could do worse than putting the replacements in it. We're back.
Yeah. Well, I also think it's like, you know, I'm never like, check out my musical knowledge, man. Like, you know.
It's just good.
Well, it's just like, this is shit that we love listening to.
I did
to.
Not know that Harmonia song, though. The Brad Eno one. That was fucking incredible.
Oh, dude, it's awesome. Yeah. The song's great. Well, also, it's interesting, too, because we have sort of found that, you know, Josh and I sort of taking on, like, the supervisor role, just because of time. Like, literally, like, we're moving so fast that it's like, it just sort of became a necessity. We did find that it was something cool about connecting with the actual bands, because we would be like, no, we're going to play the whole song for 3 minutes. And they were like, oh, that's kind of cool and different.
Yeah.
And we made a lot of great friendships that way.
This is sort of a sidetrack question, but do you think White Squall is in Richie's like Ridley Scott Mount Rushmore?
100%. Also, it's really hard to see. There is an annotated copy of the movie novelization of Black Rain on his nightstand. Yeah, it's deep.
So he's a real one.
He's a real one.
Yeah.
He's a real one. And even like his bookcase, which you can't really see, there's like the making of Blade Runner. Like, there's a lot.
How deep does it go? Like, is he Kingdom of Heaven director's cut?
Oh, Kingdom of Heaven director's cut. Yeah. I think he's like someone to watch over me town.
Yeah.
You know, like he's seen all, you know, what's funny. My
Behringer naked.
Well, you know, what's so funny. My friend Max texted me. It was sort of like White Squall. That's all I said. Yeah. I was like, it's the highest praise.
I think we got to get Richie in. We got to get Eben in character on the Big Picture podcast.
Yeah.
I feel like that would be his best.
It's amazing. Well, you know what? It's also like going back to Chris Zuccaro, who is my, you know, lifelong, like the first friend I ever made whose family owned Mr. Beef. Like, they were always so, his father who passed away while we were making the show was always so wonderful to my sister and I and let us hang out there and work there. And, you know, they had such an encyclopedic knowledge of hyper-specific filmmakers. Like, Chris can talk about William Friedkin all day and Michael Mann, and the spirit of that definitely made its way into some of Richie.
I think one of the most remarkable accomplishments of The Bear across two seasons is chefs like it and chefs respect it. We talk a lot about how, you know, if we watch a show about detectives or the military, we're like, well, that's accurate.
Yeah.
And we're responding to the truth.
Yeah, we know what that's like.
We don't know at all. But if we saw a show about, you know, music journalists or podcasters or whatever, we'd be like, okay, now let's pump the brakes.
I actually did that with an episode of In Just Like That recently. I was like watching it and there's like a podcast part. And I was like, that's not actually how the advertising industry works.
But also they were like preparing for the podcast ahead of time. And you're like, I'm going to call bullshit on it. But so that is kind of a magic trick, because even we were talking before about our mutual friend Daniel, who
DP.
Could nitpick specific things, but understands that the large project is true, you know. How do you feel like you and your team were able to accomplish this?
Honestly, man, I think it's because, and again, there's plenty of, don't worry, dude, there's plenty of people that like,
oh, I'm sure.
Oh man, I get hit every day. I'm like, oh, I can't look at fucking DMs. Like, they're all just like, you fucking suck.
You didn't let that fucking T-bone rest.
Dude, everybody nuts. But also, I do think it's because, look, there's all kinds of shit we get wrong, and production is hard. Like, you're like, you know, people point out like, that's not Lakeshore, that's not the Eden's Fair. You're like, yeah, I know. We had 2 hours, we had 2 hours to get the shot, and it was either that or nothing, or whatever it is, you know. But I think, like, in terms of like the actual chef stuff, I think it's, we always wanted to shoot for like 50% accuracy. And I think the reason I say that is because, like, look, the kitchen's gigantic because you have to fit a camera in. Mm-hmm. You have to fit sound people. Like, a lot of the kitchen is much more generous than any of these chefs and restaurateurs can deal with. But I do think there's something about it that shows its heart was in the right place. And like, we did try, and so many of our friends and family were really amazing to us, and like particularly Courtney and Maddie and their outreach. But like, you know, you say DP Daniel Patterson, who is the chef of Qua and is sort of one of these genius level cooks. you know, I spent a lot of time following him and Roy Choi around when they were going to open
local,
and watching they work, watching the way they work together was like really incredible and not dissimilar from the way Carmi and Sid do. So even if like we're not getting everything right, I do think the spirit of chasing that, like, dude, there was a day that we were at some weird, like someone was hosting a benefit at their home in New York and sort of hired like every incredible chef in New York to come visit. And I found myself watching Roy Choi, Daniel Patterson, and Renee Redzepi like taste test a chicken nugget that they were working on. And the three of them pushing each other and like taking it very seriously was like truly one of the most inspiring things, because I was like, oh man, those are like three guys with three completely different backgrounds, all sort of chasing this thing. And I think that really stuck with me, this, the spirit of that. So I think we're definitely very grateful that the restaurant community accepted us, but I also think it's like so much of it is due to, you know, my sister and Maddie and people like Daniel in my life.
Is there a little bit of a magic trick that has to happen with the food to the extent that we're told Carmi is this kind of like one of one? Luca says as much pretty much, you know, when he's talking to Lionel. And then like, you know, as the season goes on and we hear about Chaos Menu, we see glimpses of the menu here and there where we individual dishes will start to get tweaked or whatever. But we've talked a lot in discussing the episode where it's almost like the reverse that thing you do problem, like that thing you do can just play the song over and over again and they got the right song and you're just like, that would be a hit. That's right. But for Carmi's cooking, especially since food is so subjective, people have such wildly different tastes. Do you have to kind of keep it a little bit obscured what it is? Like what he's...
100%.
Yeah.
And I think that's also like, if we're lucky enough to get a season three, I think we get into that much more.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that I found being around a lot of chefs too is that like the food is almost like secondary. Like when you're building a restaurant,
well, that's because
like,
when you showed the menu on the wall, I was like, yeah, it's like a menu.
Yeah.
That's like food.
Well, I mean, it is interesting because like truly watching, you know, like people like in a 3-star Michelin restaurant, they're changing their menu every day and they do it at the end of the night, usually based on what they have or, you know, sort of what the routine is inside that restaurant. And I, at least it, what I've observed. And I think when you're building a restaurant, it's sort of like what you said about like people liking season one and then going to season two. It's like, you can't even let any of that shit in because you have to build another restaurant. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you trust yourself that the food will be okay as long as the foundation is there for it.
Also, the majority of people, the majority of meals, you don't really remember the food that much past it. You remember maybe a dish or two or a taste, but you remember the night. And you remember the company and you remember the service and the atmosphere and everything else that went around it. And I feel like that's a similar ratio that you guys bring to the show, where the human stories and their emotional arcs and their journeys, that's what we're watching. And the food is just night to night, we're going to see it. And that's the language that they're using to communicate.
Yeah, I also think we found in the making of it, like, again, because how we do the food is like my sister is essentially running a restaurant within the show, which is pretty incredible to see. And she works with Laura Roper, our props department. It's like, it is wild that they're building like a full-scaled restaurant to sort of accommodate all the food stuff. And I think the thing we've realized is some of the, you can go so into the weeds with the food stuff too. So it's like, it is a choice to be like, all right, Carmi's good at this. Like they'll figure, Sydney's good at this. We'll figure it out and we'll get into it later.
We were going to ask this and we almost forgot to, which is, so Maddie Matheson, cook, internet personality, larger than life personality, a friend of yours, but also he's a really good actor.
He's tremendous. What,
how did that, I mean, things can happen, but like there's something of the way you shot it or the positions that you put him in and then who he is, where he's just holding the screen and present in these scenes with Oliver Platt, you know, who's doing God tier work. And it's just like,
oh man, Platt rules. Well, no, Maddie, I mean, the thing that's interesting is like, I love, you know, he's one of my best friends and I love him so much. And I think it kind of goes back to he feels really safe around the cast and the crew and everyone's looking out for him. Particularly like Ebby is like his acting coach.
Yeah.
You know, like him and Evan really spend a lot of time together. And I think like going back to the unlocking thing, like him and Ricky unlock something in each other. And it was so funny because when we were sitting, you know, Duccio Fabri, our AD and I were like before we shot 206, we had to like lay out a chart and sort of walk through where everyone was sitting and where the special effects were going to happen, all that shit. And I remember when we showed Maddie's like, got it, between Bernthal and Odenkirk, fuck you. Like, he's like, okay, got it. Everyone's throwing fucking heat. And okay, cool.
So you alluded to it, Christy. If you're lucky enough to get a season three, you can't say anything. We feel strongly that you will get a season three. Not to break news to you, but we feel pretty good about it.
Knocking on wood, man.
It'll just be part of the larger MCU, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Like Julia Louis-Dreyfus has owned the rest
we got the Punisher, and we got, I think, Io's in the Marvel world. So
that's true.
Like...
The longer this goes, they'll all be eventually. You don't have a Jedi, though. I know spoilers to Andor, but Evan has a different arc. This writer's strike, which is going on now, obviously is going to affect whatever planning or pre-production and writing you have for the season. Where are you with a potential season three right now? It's just sort of a broad question. We don't want spoilers. I'm just curious where your head is at, because last year you were probably at this point.
Yeah, you were probably like,
you were already into it in season two.
I have like no concept of time anymore. I truly, because I think the turnaround of the show, like we, even on this season, I think we made it by the skin of our teeth. Like, but right before this, like minutes before this. Yeah, and I don't think anyone, you know, there was like a week where it's like the strike might happen or it might not happen. And we were like, we should probably boogie, dude. So we cut this in a like reckless amount of time. And I think, you know, I hope this strike is over soon and everyone gets treated fairly and we can move on. But I think in terms of season three, we have the map for, we sort of know where it's going. Mm-hmm. So we're lucky in that. I mean, again, it's like, you know, working with FX was pretty great that was sort of from the jump, we knew where it was headed.
I almost wonder whether or not like I was curious whether or not like any of that, this delay or whatever it would be, like it would inform the story at all, because there's so much compression for the first two seasons and so much intensity. And then there's like this weird breath, and
season three picks up 4 years later and they're doing fast casual.
I can promise no time jumps, but I do think it's that thing of kind of what I was saying earlier, where we have incredible writers. And I think like, I think everyone kind of knows that we always leave room for sort of the unexpected. Sure. And I think that's what we did this year. But yeah, I mean, again, the show is so insanely fast that a break might be kind of nice. Yeah. But, you know, it's a good problem to have if we have to do it.
You got to, your next project, you got to go full Terrence Malick and just shoot it for like 6 years and just like go off and shoot a leaf.
Yeah, I was like, I know we made our show, you know, in 2 months, pretty start to finish. So let's take a couple of years and really.
You could try, what was that word you said? Fun.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what's interesting though, dude? I do know that, you know, everyone kind of gets worried about shows disappearing for a while. And, you know, that's something we think a lot about. But I don't know, if we're lucky to do it again, I think we got a good handle on it.
Good.
And we didn't even, you know, we didn't even talk to you about this Don Winslow thing.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to adapt this great
Don
Winslow novel.
So if that happens, I by the way, I'm like, I don't believe anything until like, on set. Koppelman and Levine, man, they wrote this script. It's one of the best things I've ever read. Yeah. And it's also like, it's got a little bit of a history of people trying to figure it out. And I think if we could do it, it would be special. And
that's exciting.
But we'll see what happens.
It's about to be like Don Winslow season two, right? Because they like City on Fire is getting made.
I heard somebody.
I thought you meant
because
of the election next.
Oh yeah,
that's what I call election season.
You know, Carmi just goes full Frankie Machine in season three.
Yeah,
it's
just bring them all together. Dude, thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
Thank
guys.
You for
it was
the show.
Awesome.
We're
you guys are the coolest. It means a lot.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.